Thanks for joining us on our third episode on the series of asthma. In this episode, we are delving into another mechanism of action, one we have not talked about, called beta 2 agonism, which is an albuterol rescue inhaler. It's one of the most commonly prescribed medications. Everyone has seen it. It can make a profoundly positive impact in people with asthma. So we're going to explain what that is. And again, as I mentioned before, it's a beta 2 agonist. So in the last episode, we talked about antagonists, acetylcholine antagonism. So acetylcholine is how the parasympathetic nervous system communicates from nerve to nerve, okay? And different medications are different plants. For example, like Jimson weed and Atropa belladonna were found to actually inhibit the receptor for acetylcholine. Now we're talking about actually a receptor agonist, meaning it actually triggers that receptor. That's a different component of the nervous system that we refer to as the sympathetic nervous system. And I'll get into that in a minute. But let's start with a plant similar to the last episode. We're going to dig into Mongolia in the 1700s. So let's say you're a kid, 12-year-old in Mongolia. So, you know, you're just about midlife, right? And you are running on the large grassy plains, but your brother can always beat you, and you had a hard time keeping up with him. He always felt like your lungs couldn't keep up with your body. You'd want to run, you'd want to catch up, but your lungs would keep you from that. Then one day your dad comes with this kind of satchel of grassy leaves, and he burns the plant, and that smoke comes, and he tells you to inhale and suck it in and hold it. And all of a sudden, you can feel your lungs open up. You can run, you can breathe, but you also notice your heart racing at the same time. So again, this probably sounds really similar to the last episode with Jimson weed and Atropa belladonna, which did similar things, including causing tachycardia, or the fast heart rate. But we didn't know what was actually the chemical in it. So it wasn't until 1885 when the compound from these plants was isolated by a Japanese pharmaceutical chemist, Nage Nagayashi, and he actually called it ephedrine. So this is something you've probably heard of before. Ephedrine helped relax the bronchial muscles. So it was used as a very common treatment for asthma up into the 1950s. So as they found out that this plant helped, similar to other plants, but it turns out ephedrine works extremely differently compared to the other plants, which were Jimson weed and Atropa belladonna. So to understand the story of how ephedrine works, we need to establish another vasoactive compound. And for that, we actually go start back to the story of medieval Europe. You're a peasant. You're tending fields of rye. It's what you do. One day, while you're out in the fields, you notice a pregnant cow walking in the distance. You know she's due to give a calf in the next few weeks, and you're very, very happy. You know this cow will be able to give plenty of milk to help get through the next winter. Okay? You watch the cow walk over to some grass, and you forget about her. But then a few moments later, you take a look again and spot her, and she's eating blackened stalks of rye. So you know what these blackened stalks of rye are. Your father warned you about them. Every year during the harvest, you would find blackened rye, and your father would put it to the side and burn it. Okay, I said, don't eat it. Don't eat the blackened rye. Your father told stories of years of starvation with bad harvest, and people would have to eat the blackened rye, and it made people extremely sick. Okay, some people even died. And you take a look down at the area where the cow is eating, and quite a bit of the rye is gone. And you're like, oh no. What's going to happen? So you get really nervous. Should you tell your father? Should you not? You decide not to tell him. You don't know. Maybe it won't bother a cow at all. Later that night, you hear something moaning, right, from a cow. You knew it. The cow's going to get sick and die like the people do who eat the blackened rye. In a panic, you run around the corner, and there the cow is laying on her side. But lo and behold, a calf has just been birthed. And you're stunned because the cow wasn't due for many weeks. But the cow looks like it's doing okay, and the calf, which was just birthed, that looks like it's being okay as well. And then you wonder, wait, could this blackened rye have something to do with the cow giving birth early? And that, dear listeners, is the story, perhaps true, but perhaps apocryphal, of how ergot, what is now known as the fungus on the rye, was discovered to cause uterine contractions in the Middle Ages. And this led to doctors using the fungus growing on rye to actually induce pregnancies and many things, even induce abortions in women during the 1700s, 1800s. And stories say that it was just because of medieval peasants recognizing cows giving early birth after eating all this black fungi called ergot that grew on the rye. So how do we start elucidating the little, you know, the puzzle of what ergot is? Well, in the year 1904, at the age of 29, we get Dr. Henry Hallett Dale, Yes, the Henry Dale mentioned in the last episode helping elucidate acetylcholine. Before that, he actually joined the Burroughs Wellcome Research Laboratory in London. They were researching compounds trying to understand the physiologic impact and potential medications. And he was tasked with the tricky problem of ergot. People had tried to tackle the mystery of this fungus before, but people didn't really get anywhere. And some of the things they had, you know, they had tissue were they actually able to get from guinea pig uteruses, keep them in a saline bath, keep them alive, and then kind of like put the ergot onto uterus and see it contract. So they're actually able to do these ex vivo experiments, meaning outside of the body experiments, to measure its tissue reaction. They were able to get blood vessels from guinea pigs and other rodents and actually measure and keep them perfused and then drop the ergot on them and also see the vessel tissue contract. Okay, so they're actually able to measure this pretty well, but still don't know what in that fungus from the rye, what it was. Okay, so Dell and his team got to work, eventually finding ergot contained multiple chemicals, many with conflicting physiologic effects. He named one of them ergotamine and the other one ergometrine. Great names. I can't imagine any confusion moving forward.
Oh God, an explosive! Quick, get me ergotamine. It's the only thing that can neutralize the trigger.
Got it right here. Ergometrine.
No, ergotamine, not ergometrine.
Ergotamine? Ergometrine.
But at least now they can study the proteins much better and gain an appreciation of their physiologic role. The vascular constriction was a particular major interest, but we didn't know how it was doing it. But then something interesting happened. One of his team members received a cat adrenal gland, the gland above the kidneys, and was tasked with studying one of its excretions called adrenaline. So adrenaline was well known at that time. Adrenaline was given and that raised blood pressure. It raised heart rate, okay? And it's known to be what's called a potent sympathomimetic, okay? What is this thing, sympathomimetic? Sympathomimetic is a medication that mimics the sympathetic nervous system. Adrenaline was a chemical compound that Dr. Dale used to understand how the sympathetic system talks. Oh, by the way, this is a quick little aside. So one of the confusing things about adrenaline is we call it two different things. We call it adrenaline when we talk about the physiologic effect and its role in human physiology. But when it's given in the hospital, we call it epinephrine. The natural question to this conundrum is, why do we have two different names for this, right? So the word adrenaline makes a whole lot of sense because it comes from the adrenal glands. Adrenaline, adrenal glands. Yay, that sort of makes sense. Med students are like, yeah, I got this. Thank you for whoever logically named that, right? Well, I can tell you. So it was first isolated by the Japanese biochemist Jokichi Takamine. The hormone was patented by Park Davis Pharmaceuticals. When he discovered it, a pharmaceutical company patented adrenaline. Okay. So after that, people studying it were nervous to publish utilizing the patented name of the hormone. So they instead changed it to epinephrine when they're talking about it in the scientific literature and giving it to patients. They used epinephrine so they wouldn't mess with the patent of the adrenaline. Now back to ergotamine. Remember, ergotamine was that vasoconstrictor, and adrenaline was a sympathomimetic mimicking the sympathetic nervous system, and is also a vasoconstrictor, okay? So Dr. Dell is wondering, well, what would happen if you give both of these? Maybe that'll help us understand better. So if you give an animal ergotamine first, you see the animal's blood pressure rise. So if you then give them adrenaline, are they working on the same receptor, meaning that you'll have a compounded effect and the blood pressure will go even higher, or will the effects cancel each other out and the blood pressure won't change at all? He didn't know. So he gave one animal ergotamine, caused the blood pressure to go up. Then he let it stew for a little while. Then they gave the same animal adrenaline. And guess what? The blood pressure lowered. So two vasoactive compounds that drive the blood pressure up when given together caused the blood pressure to go down. Okay? That one experiment opened the door to understanding alpha and beta receptors, which led to eventually albuterol and beta agonists, beta antagonists, beta blockers. You've probably heard all this comes from that recognition that ergotamine and adrenaline together did the opposite reaction of what everyone thought it was going to do. So how did that possibly happen? Dr. Dell recognized that ergotamine was somehow reversing adrenaline. And he argued that adrenaline must be working on two distinct receptor mechanisms. One causing vasoconstriction, which is being blocked by the ergotamine, and the other causing the vasodilation being unmasked by the blockade. It seemed to have opposing impacts depending on the organ system involved. For example, in some blood vessels, like within the digestive system, it seemed to cause vasoconstriction, and in the lungs, it seemed to cause pulmonary dilation. So this brought to the question, does the sympathetic nervous system function on a single receptor or multiple? I.e. one vascular bed would have one receptor type, and another vascular bed would have another receptor type. So this was how adrenaline worked. It acted differently in different components of the body. But then even adrenaline's impact of one vessel will change and be flipped if ergotamine was added to it as well. So the ergotamine kind of gave us an additional understanding of what drives our sympathetic nervous system. All of this is clearly demonstrating there's more than one receptor that is being triggered here, okay? So how do we sort this out? How many receptors are there? What are these different receptors doing on different tissue with different receptors? So luckily, we can answer this by using multiple sympathetic mimics. So there's different sympathetic mimics. And there's a doctor who realized he can probably start gaining a better understanding of their receptors based on how all the mimics respond to different tissue. Dr. Raymond Altquist, a pharmacologist who grew up in Montana from two Swedish parents, he was interested in the conundrum of sympathetic mimic and designed a study to better understand it. So they had these sympathetic mimics, and they all do different things depending on what tissue and what dose was being given, and it was confusing everybody. So he said, okay, well, I'm going to get one blood vessel, get one uterus, I'm going to give the same amount of each of these, norepinephrine, epinephrine, isoproterenol, and see what response these drugs have. And he found out that norepinephrine had the biggest impact on vasoconstriction, next to epinephrine, next to isoproterenol. Then for tachycardia, isoproterenol had the biggest impact, then epinephrine, then norepinephrine. So there's this kind of rank order list of response depending on the sympathetic agonism. So Altquist reasoned, if a single receptor responsible for all adrenergic responses or sympathetic responses, the potency ranking of agonists should be similar in every tissue. So again, arguing there must be more than one receptor, and he thus named it alpha receptor to mediate vasoconstriction and beta receptor to mediate cardiac stimulation, vasodilation, and bronchodilation. So this is a big deal. It gives us both alpha and beta receptors for sympathetic activity. Each of these receptors does different things on different tissues, and beta agonists were known to cause bronchodilation. So as you can imagine, this was a target for the treatment of asthma. Was epinephrine ever used for asthma? And the answer is yes. They would often administer the medicine subcutaneously, so if they inject the epinephrine, and that really kind of helped people breathe. Some people actually would go and self-administer their own injection every night before bed, but it caused, you know, anxiety, it caused tremors, it caused the heart rate to go up. So it wasn't the most pleasant method of treatment for asthma. And then we have ephedrine. So ephedrine, as I mentioned before, was what was discovered in Mongolia. Well, it wasn't discovered in Mongolia, but that was one of the places where the plants grew. They had ephedrine. So that was smoked for a long time and inhaled to treat the onset of symptoms of asthma. And again, ephedrine was having an agonistic response affecting the lungs and helping open up the lungs, but also caused tachycardia because it was also a beta agonist. So we were kind of taking advantage of these natural occurring compounds like epinephrine, adrenaline, which was made from, you know, adrenal glands of cows, was taken out and used. Ephedrine was taken from these plants, right? But it wasn't until we actually get isoproterenol, which is actually the first ever human-made beta agonist released in the 1950s. It can be inhaled. It had a strong bronchodilator effect and actually stronger than epinephrine. And you didn't have to stab yourself every night to take it. You could just inhale it. Okay. So this was clearly seen as a major advancement in the treatment of asthma. So life looks good for a little while for patients suffering from asthma. Now you have an inhaled beta agonist. So it causes the heart rate to go up a little bit, but you don't have to stab yourself. Things are looking good, right? But it would turn out it started causing some deaths. So let me get to that. It led to the asthma death epidemic, right? So that sounds pretty bad. It is bad. In the 1960s, epidemiologists came around and pointed out a spike in asthma deaths occurring over the previous 10 years. Predominantly, it occurred among patients aged 5 to 34 years old. Deaths went from 0.7 per 100,000 people to 2.2 per 100,000 people. So over a threefold increase in deaths. And much ink was spilled trying to understand why, looking at aerosols to pollution. But fingers did start to begin wagging at isoproterenol as a potential risk. Some studies showing isoproterenol didn't help with oxygenation, and others showed kids could build tolerance to the medication, with some reports showing a rebound effect, where after the cessation of the isoproterenol, attacks would become more severe than before the medication was started. And that would seem to be much more apparent at higher doses. And the kids, unfortunately, would begin to feel it's not working as well. So they'd keep puffing and taking more and more and more. And they got this bigger rebound at the end that it potentially causes more vasoconstriction down the road. So after the increased deaths in isoproterenol inhalation, you might think, oh, I guess that's the end of beta agonist as we know it. But nay, that was not, because it turns out there's not just one beta receptor, but there are two beta receptors, at least two beta receptors at this point. So then we got a huge leap, okay, when they found out that because, again, how these receptors worked, some beta agonists appear to stimulate the heart very strongly and the bronchi less strongly, while others produced powerful bronchodilation and less cardiac stimulation. So even within beta agonists, there are some differences in how their heart rate responded versus lung responded, where the heart rate would go up high, just a little bit high versus really high, depending on how the beta agonist was used. And that actually led to a different potency ranking. Remember, the ranking system of the different sympathetic mimics led to the understanding of alpha and beta receptors. It turns out in 1967, we further delineated the receptors with additional pharmacokinetic work, and they found that there's actually not one, but two beta receptors, okay? This was a giant leap. Before, they were going after all betas. But then they found out that there's beta 2 and there's beta 1. And beta 1 is primarily in the heart. Only one heart, one beta 1. And there's two, the beta 2 and the two lungs. Right? So now you can primarily target the lungs versus primarily target the heart. And that, my friends, led to the era of albuterol. The medicine was first launched in 1969 as Ventolin, okay, in the UK. And that was the first beta 2 receptor agonist. So that had much less impact on the heart rate, produced that bronchodilatory effect. And it's still the most popular rescue inhaler ever made. And you see kids running around with it all the time. Even one of my kids has an albuterol inhaler with him all the time. It's really a life-saving treatment for patients. It works very quickly. And it doesn't typically have that major heart rate increase that we saw with non-selective beta agonism. And this led to long-acting beta agonists, some that you inhale and they last 12 to 24 hours. So you have the short-acting ones where you can inhale during an attack, or you get the long-acting ones that you take preemptively to decrease the risk of a flare during the day. So it really changed how we understand and how we are able to approach the treatment of asthma. So thanks for listening to Mechanisms of Action. Please, if you like us, tell your friends about us, give us a 5-star review. And we would appreciate it, and we'll look forward to the next episode.